House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, April 26, 2011. We're going to go out of order. We have a lot of people here on House Bill 67A, so we're going to address that one first. I'd like to call Jim Spitz and Jan Spitz, please.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 67A comes from the Department of State Police to permit use of the Internet to provide information to the public about predatory adult sex offenders. Current law requires agencies that supervise sex offenders in Oregon to release information upon request as necessary to protect the public. This would allow the Department of State Police to publish specified information about predatory sexually violent offenders on its website via lists by city, zip code, or county. And it requires information about juvenile sex offenders to be provided on a request-by-request basis when the offender is identified by their full name, not over the Internet. It declares an emergency is effective on passage.
Okay, thank you. Please start, either one of you, whoever wants to go first. Be sure to identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Barker. My name is Jim Spitz. I make my living as a consultant. I'm from Bend, Oregon, and I have submitted written testimony, so you can read more about me in there if you'd like to know more. I've not testified to a committee like this before, but the subject came up and I felt compelled to come and talk to you and the members of the Justice Committee, and I really appreciate your allowing me to do this. Please give me some guidance if you need to.
Since we have this, you don't need to read it to us, and if you could summarize, that would be great.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is just bounce through a few highlights. And I know you guys can read this. I hope you will read it later on your own.
That'd be fine. Thank you.
But the highlights are my main reason for being here is I know a young man who is potentially going to be listed on the public list of sex offenders, and I've known him for a long time since his birth. I think he's a wonderful person. He made a mistake is what it really comes down to. This happened when he was 14 years old. I really don't want to go into the details. It was kind of a youthful curiosity thing. Curiosity of a 14-year-old boy. This was reported to the police. He went clear through the treatment system. He cooperated in every way with everything he was ever asked to do. He did it with enthusiasm, and I think he's truly sorry about what happened. But now, because he has cooperated, he's come to the position where he turned 18. He was taken off of probation, therefore he is not under supervision. The fact that he was taken out of supervision makes him eligible to be put on the list of sex offenders that's publicly available. And I think this is kind of tragic. He was told that he had to be off. He had to be, after he turned 18 and was off probation, he was told he had to stay out of trouble with the police for 2 years, that he could petition to be taken off the list, and things would be fine. I expect that he will be taken off the list. Unfortunately, the emergency status of this bill, only 1 year's gone by, he will be put on the list before he can get his name taken off the list by following the rules. So this has caused a lot of concern for me. Basically, he's gone through a lot of trauma. He's very regretful. His family has gone through a lot of trauma. Frankly, I think that he's an example of a person that maybe there was not a benefit, there was harm for going through this legal procedures that he had to go through. So I'm concerned that there not be any more trauma for him. And just moving rather quickly through the rest of my stuff that I just would like to point out, is one thing is I think our society does a really terrible job with young children in matters of sex. I'm sure you're aware that you watch television, you look at the Internet, you go to a movie. There's just lots of places where there's sort of a glorification of sex, and cool people are sexually active. If you watch television, etc. When you take a 14-year-old boy or any young child, and they see this, and they see the glorification and the glamour and everything, And they don't have, their mind is not fully developed. They don't have great judgment yet. They can't write a contract. They can't do a lot of things in society. And yet we hold them responsible for some of their behavior. And in this case, this potentially puts him on a list potentially for life that damages him through the rest of his life. It's a person with huge promise. And it seems to me that this is not good. So I looked at the testimony. I've looked at some documents that summarize Senate Bill 67. I'm not an attorney. I know it has been amended. I was unable to find out what the amendment was, so I'm talking about the bill without the amendment. And my concerns were mostly that I think that when this passed through the Senate, state Senate, it was by a 30-0 vote. And I listened to the testimony that was available on the Internet, et cetera, and it seemed to me there was just very, very shallow coverage of this, and that people who within the Senate may have had the idea that this is pretty innocuous. It's good to be hard on crime, and it's also sex offenders are not popular. So there was easy to vote yes, but I don't think there was a real digging into what the consequences are. So I'd just like to briefly go through some consequences. Number one, according to the staff summary that I read, there's thought to be no revenue impact from passage of this bill. I'm somewhat cynical about that. On the Internet, the Bureau of Justice Statistics estimates a cost of over $6 million for the first year for Oregon to participate in the Adam Walsh Act, which is a similar thing. And there are states who are already somewhat participating, have these programs, one being Michigan. And I'll point out, Michigan didn't spend much money on their program. And it went, as I understand it, very badly. It audited by the state of Michigan's notification program. They said, this is a quote, the program still contains inaccurate and incomplete information. It may give the public a false sense of security. So what I'm saying there is if you're going to have a program like this, you need to fund it well, and there are dangers. And if it's done wrong, it does harm. You can imagine a situation where this is on the Internet and hackers start going after it and they start deleting information or deleting people's names, or they start trying to put other people's names on. They don't like their neighbor or something. They put his name on there and his picture, and pretty soon, I mean, it just can go wrong. So it's a complicated process and needs to be done right if it's done. And I fear that it's not for free. Another thing is that this seems to have been portrayed as a small change, not much of a change from current situation. Well, I think it's a big change. Right now, there is a notification system that includes predatory and dangerous offenders. There's about 700 people on that list. It's my understanding that this would put on lower-level offenders, including people who were juvenile offenders, bringing the list up to 14,000, 15,000 people. And that's a massive increase. That's a 20-fold increase. One of the things happens when you put a 20-fold increase to this, there is no scaling of the risk with these people. It kind of dilutes people's focus on the truly dangerous people. And has people in there who aren't truly dangerous. That's sort of a problem. The other thing is, if you think about this, and this is a simplistic mathematics that obviously isn't perfectly right, but if you say how many people are in Oregon, and I think there's something like 3.6 million, and you say, well, half of them are men, and if you say, if you take 15,000 people and put them on this list, that's like one out of every 100 men in the state of Oregon end up on this list as sex offenders. Well, that's a pretty scary thing to the public. People who are concerned are going to be thinking they're everywhere, you know. And I'm not sure that's helpful. This dilution. We've got to focus on the people that are dangerous and predatory. Okay. A few other items. I got the impression from testimony to the Senate that state has to do this. And there was talk about, well, because of HUD and federal housing rules, we have to have this. You'll see notes within my stuff that I refer to everything, things to the best of my ability I've documented, cited where I get my information. But I've read HUD's rules. All HUD's rules say is once a year you have to ask people, is there a, quote, lifetime sex offender, registered sex offender in your family? And have you checked this national database to verify this? There's no requirement for a state program. In fact, some states are going with the federal program. I can't even pronounce the name, DER. SOGIN, National Sex Offender Database. Anyway, some states are going with it. Some are going in a modified form. Some states are just saying, we're not going to do that. So I don't think there's a federal requirement to do this. And I heard testimony to the effect that, well, for the lower level offenders, we don't give as much information, so they're protected. Well, they give, from what I can determine, person's name, person's date of birth, and through the sorting system, you know what city and or zip code they live in. Now, I'm not a rocket scientist, but I'll tell you, I can go on the internet, and in 5 minutes, given somebody's name, date of birth, zip code, I can compile a dossier on them. I can tell you where they live. I can probably tell you where they work. I might even get a picture of them. So there's really not protection given the information given out even on the low-level people to kind of obscure them a little bit. Another thing that was said is, if people are, let's say, found not guilty in a subsequent proceeding or they petition and have their names removed, that protects them. We take them right off the list. Well, I'm not sure that does protect them. Once you put something on the internet, it's there forever. And there are businesses out there that are actually, their business is telling people who sex offenders are. Can we trust them to clean their database? Or are they going to take, you probably all looked on the internet to try to look up somebody's phone number, and pretty soon you get a thing that says, send us some money and we'll tell you all about this person's legal history and that. Are companies like that really going to remove people's names and contact information, identity information, if they are taken off the list? I don't know that we can trust them. It's to their advantage in some sense to create suspicion, to create concern, because it helps them market their product. And so, oops, I'm having trouble turning pages here. So I guess I'm not a lawyer. I question something of the legality of this. I've been taught that what we do is we try people based on the rules that exist at the time the crime was committed, and we sentence them, and we carry out that sentence. This almost seems like adding a major new punishment to someone who may have already done his time, made his amends, and now we're coming back and throwing a huge stigma on that person, an additional punishment. I wonder if that's right to do, especially with these juveniles. It could be 40 years later, and you've got someone maybe on there that did something when they were a child. So it is my hope that the House Judiciary Committee and Oregon government in general will take a courageous and compassionate stand on these kind of issues and do what's right. And I know that's not easy right now. Being tough on crime is popular, and sex offenders are not popular. And a superficial look, voting against this, would look bad. It's my hope that this committee will, at a minimum, take some time to think about this, and we'll do some amending. I really think we need to think about, should juveniles, people whose crime was when they were juvenile, be taken off of this? How about those really low-level offenders? Some of them, they just made a mistake, and they're not hardened criminals. Do they really belong in here, diluting the attention on the truly dangerous people? So at the end of my testimony, you're welcome to read it. There's just a little comment from Oregon Live. It's a blog posted by someone who is obviously a sex offender. And it shows some of the trauma that he's gone through. He says, you know, he's been punished for 13 years now for being in love with his girlfriend. Obviously, she was probably under 18 at the time. He was convicted of a misdemeanor. He says he's been borderline suicidal ever since. He now has a 2-year-old child. If he's put on this list, she and everyone will know about this occurrence. He's, you know, and he's emotional enough to say he's going to get a gun, and he hates everyone. Now, I know that's extreme, but you know, people put into this social context of being shamed like this really do terrible things. This legislation would allow even some minor crimes to put people on the list. Sexual misconduct, public indecency. We're talking things like somebody could have been skinny dipping, or someone could have urinated publicly and end up on this list. Maybe brought in from another state when they moved from Oregon, because other states have different and rules than we have, but they're sex offenders if they move here. Anyway, I'm done, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your patience.
You're more than welcome, and because you're the first time, we, you know, went a little longer. Usually we curtail to about 5 minutes, but that's fine. We appreciate you coming down and taking the time to make your presentation. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Chairman Barker and Chairman Krieger. My name is Jan Spitz. I'm related to Jim Spitz by marriage. And I am motivated to be here for exactly the same reasons. A very close family to us was rocked to its core by events that have been excruciatingly difficult to talk to and impossible to talk about publicly. And as you know, it was a 14-year-old boy detained for sexually abusing a younger sibling. And that's hard enough, but the oversight provided by the state and various agencies has been an incredibly difficult process for this family to navigate through. That's my motivation for being here. So this has been on my plate, on my radar screen for the last 4 years. I've done a lot of reading. I've read laws. I've read reports. Is this really necessary? Is this level of punishment really necessary? What is being accomplished by these punitive bills? I tried to read Senate Bill 67. Well, I did read Senate Bill 67. It took me literally hours to parse through it to figure out what it says. And I edited it on my computer, deleted all of the curly bracket comments. I diagrammed it. And finally, I stumbled across an article in the Statesman Journal by Peter Wong, where he basically highlighted the bill very briefly. And I thought, oh, that's what it's about. And then I read the bill again. I said, no, I don't think so. I think he's got it wrong. And then I decided, no, he's got it right. It took a long time. And finally, I called Vi Beatty, who is the manager of the Sex Offender Registry Program. And Vi, I think, is here. And a lot of my testimony, in my written testimony, is response to comments that she made. And with all due respects to Vi, I have to say, I had a wonderful conversation with her. She was very forthcoming. She was honest. She was sympathetic. She was supportive. This is a person I would love to go have coffee with. Nevertheless, I had some real problems with her testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Basically, what the bill says, and this never really was totally spelled out before the Senate Judiciary Committee in very crisp terms, and I really doubt that it reached the attention of the Senate members. In fact, to punctuate my point, here is a summary of the staff summary of the bill, this is what it says. This allows the Department of State Police to publish specified information about predatory sexually violent offenders on its website by city, state, zip, requires information about juvenile offenders to be provided as by request based on when the offender is identified by name. Holy cow! It does way more than this. There are 700 predatory sexual offenders currently on the state's registry. They're already on the internet. They've been on the internet for years. What this bill does is it takes the other people, the low-level offenders, and requires that, it permits the police to upload all of their names to the web, and it will be done. How many of these people are there? Nobody seemed very curious about asking. There are a total of 17,000 names on the registry. 700 of them are predatory. How many of these are people who screwed up when they were kids, did something 20 years ago, are low-level, not officially not at risk offenders, and their names are going to go on the internet for everybody in their community to see, listed by city, zip, county. I would like to think that there would be some interest in getting some information. How many people are going to be affected? How many low-level offenders are going to be affected? How many people are going to lose jobs, housing, social support, be shunned by their community because their name appears on the list? There doesn't seem to be any answers, and there's a deplorable lack of curiosity about it. That's why I'm here. I want to see you asking, show us the evidence, show us the numbers. If you vote on this without this information, I would think if a business did this, if somebody came forward to a board of directors and say, I'm going to propose a major change to our policy, but I'm not providing any document, it's just going to increase profits, I think that business would be out of business.
We do have a witness coming forward that will ask those questions.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That's good to hear. I was not going to go through my whole written testimony. It was rather long because I didn't know whether or not I was going to be able to be here, but I am, obviously. So I'd like to just hit a couple of the salient points that really bother me about this bill.
Okay.
Number one, this is promoted, and this is the biggie. The promotion, the rallying cry is this is necessary to keep us safe. Or more poignantly, this is necessary to keep our children safe. Well, document this. Where's the evidence? How many offenders on this list have reoffended? Show us numbers. Even anecdotal evidence would be helpful. That has not been forthcoming. The reality is that these public community notification measures do not keep us any safer. And if you read the literature over and over again, that comes out. In my testimony, my written testimony, there's a quote from an organization, a little organization called Human Rights Watch, that says outright, these do not help. One of the reasons, only about 10% of sex offenses result in conviction. Okay, with a little bit of liberty with math, if only 10% of offenses result in conviction, I think we can speculate that somehow 90% of offenders are still out there. They have not been reported, they haven't been convicted, and their names are not on the registry. If they had been convicted, of course, their names would be on the registry. This is a lifetime registry. So the majority... And this makes sense. So many of these offenses occur in families, and they occur by people who are known to the family or among friends. They don't report each other. It doesn't get reported. Or maybe a violent offender was never caught and never identified. I think it's very safe to say, however, that probably half of the offenders out there are not on the registry. What kind of comfort can a person take by glancing through the registry and saying that, I don't see, I see these names, I must be safe, when there's all these other names that aren't on the registry? There's the idea that this is keeping us safe seems a little bit bizarre. Another statistic that seems pretty common is about 80 to 90% of the sex offenses committed against children occur in the home. It occurs in the family or by somebody known to the family. What good does this internet registry do us when this is the prevailing situation? Okay, second concern, what harm is done to the people whose names that get posted on this list? The young boy that we were talking about in this family that's very close to us. This kid has gone on to complete high school with a nearly 4-point GPA. He was on several athletic teams. He appeared, participated in athletics. He held part-time jobs all throughout school, really neat jobs, too, apprentice-type jobs. He's done an incredible job, and the fact that he's been able to do this with what he's gone through has been nothing less than a miracle. I maintain that the only reason he was able to do this was that he had the cover of anonymity. The people who knew about this were the school administrators and the counselors. They did not feel that it was appropriate to share this with his teachers or his classmates. If that information was out there about him, criminy, high school is tough enough under the best of circumstances. I mean, abuse is everywhere. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what it would be like to be in school and have everybody know this isn't just Johnny, this is a sex offender? The kid becomes a label. And kids will be uploaded to the internet as soon as they're off of supervision, as soon as they complete probation, their name goes live on the internet. That's one of the provisions of this bill.
I do need you to summarize now.
Okay. My summary is I think it's absolutely critical that we know what's going to happen to people. Jim mentioned a testimony from a young man who submitted a comment to the Oregon Live website that he's going to buy an unregistered firearm, and we're going to have one less offender to worry about. We'll be safer. There are stories out there. There's several in my testimony about parents who have lost children to suicide. We know that suicide is an epidemic among teenagers. This is going to be one more motivating force, I think, for that. Folks, I appreciate so much the opportunity to speak. This is the first time that we've been able to speak about it. This is an incredibly painful subject. And I want to commend the House for passage of Senate Bill 2707. I was really encouraged to see that we care about keeping juveniles out of adult jails. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and appreciate your coming down and testifying. I understand it is difficult, especially the first time down. So thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Next, I'll call Sterling Alexander and John Zolkowski. I think that is. Probably said that wrong. Please go ahead and just be sure to identify yourself for the record when you begin.
My name is Sterling Alexander, and I'm representing a civil rights organization from Portland and Salem area called Truth and Justice for All.
You can go ahead if you like. First.
Continue. Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, I wanted to kind of start off just kind of talking to you about a recent incident that happened, and even though this Senate Bill 67 hasn't been enacted, it just kind of shows some of the potential things that it may cause down the line for sex offenders who have to register, even low-level sex offenders. And this incident happened about 3 weeks ago. It was here in Oregon, and I'll refer to the gentleman's name. He wanted some anonymity. His name is Greg. I won't say his last name. He was living in a boarding house, and some people in the area, they was described as some gang members, discovered that Greg was a registered sex offender. At that time, they began to harass him, and then threatened him with physical bodily harm, started extorting money from him, and then tried to get him to sign over his car to them. They came to him one evening and told him that he had 10 minutes to pack up his stuff and get out of here, get out of the neighborhood. And so, in which he did, and he's residing in a transitional, it's a Christian transitional facility. From that, he was just a wreck when he came into the transitional facility, and almost lost his job because of that, because he stopped going to work and things like that. And from what I discovered with Greg is that he is considered a low-risk sex offender. Nobody saw him on a registry, nobody saw him online or anything like that. It was just something that was discovered somehow through the community he lived in. And speaking for truth and justice for all, you know, and looking at Senate Bill 67 from our understanding, is that we're not asking that it be totally eliminated, because we believe that establishing an online data system for our predatory sex offenders and high-risk sex offender is something that would be a valuable resource for different agencies, different communities, different organizations that are screening, you know, applicants that come into jobs and to participate in organizations. And it also helps with promote the safety and welfare of all the Oregon communities. But one thing that we're kind of opposed to, as Mr. Spitz was referring to, was the low-level sex offenders. So that's kind of what I'm speaking towards today. And I did provide some testimony to all the members on board. And so kind of with that, truth and justice all is kind of opposed to creating a so-called double jeopardy to the low-risk or no-risk sex offender. These, the ones that I'm referring to, are the sex offenders that have proved positive change in their lives and the lives of their families. Those who have completed their programs, that were required to, you know, go through treatment programs and things like that, they've completed those with no issues, no problems. They've paid, kept up with their financial obligations, paid their restitutions, paid their fines, and things like that, and their probation fees and things of that nature. These are the low level or to no risk that have not reoffended or have gone on to continue committing crimes. And so some of these, many of these have assimilated themselves in their communities. They've established or reestablished their families. They're gainfully employed. Some that I've discovered have become business owners. They're volunteering in their communities. They're serving in their local churches and in other civic organizations. Some of these considered sex offenders, some are on probation, some are on limited probation, some are on inactive probation, and some are not on probation at all anymore. And despite the stigma of being labeled as a sex offender, there are some sex offenders that have no restrictions of being around children at all. So, you know, something like Senate Bill 67 could affect that rapport and that relationship that they have with friends, families, business co-workers, and things like that. And so the Truth and Justice for All is just asking that you carefully and prayerfully consider about not placing the low-level sex offenders that kind of meet that type of criteria. And I think that, and maybe it's a change in the verbiage within the Senate Bill 67, because I think with, you know, between the OSB, the registration that, you know, the mandatory, the ones that do register, between the parole and probation departments, between all law enforcement agencies, I think they can cultivate a list of high risk and, you know, low risk or predatory and things like that. That way that would alleviate the low-level sex offender. And one of the things that Mr. Spitz was talking about ascertaining information, it's true. I think you can ascertain information from someone and find them exactly. I just for example, I worked a case, an advocacy for the Truth and Justice for All, and Eugene never knew the guy, only had his name, and in a matter of probably 2 hours, I found the guy sitting on the couch watching television. So through, you know, websites and things of that nature, social media, people can be tracked very easily. And so Truth and Justice, we're just asking that you, you know, consider and prayerfully think about changing the verbiage that reflect that only predatory and high-risk sex offenders be placed on the OSP online data system, you know, so that men and women who have proved positive changes in their lives and have gone on to, you know, be a benefit to their communities, to be an asset in their communities, reestablishing their families, because it potentially puts, you know, their children, their families, extended families, at potential risk. And so, you know, it's just things like the recent incident that, you know, we would not like to see happen in the future.
Thank you very much.
So thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Zalkowski. I'm affected by this proposal, and I have a background in information technology, and I would like to speak from the perspective of the technology that we're speaking about implementing here.
Okay, I don't want to cut you short, but we do have several other bills today, too. So.
Okay, yeah, I'll keep it.
Just go ahead.
Restrict to 5 minutes.
Well, that'd be great. Thank
yes.
you very much.
Thank you, sir. I oppose this measure basically for the main reason that it takes the control and pulls it away from the Oregon State Police. Once you open up all these names onto the registry, third-party sites, third parties can come and basically gather that information. I hope you'll review my documentation. It's rather technical, but there are devices called web crawlers and bots that go out and pull information. And the way that the proposed method is by zip code, city, automated resources can go out onto the web and pull those names. I've also included in my packet some screens, snapshots from some websites that take that information. They reformat it and display it on commercial websites, taking away all notice about whether the person's a predator or not. Basically, what you're doing if you pass this measure is giving a gift to the 700 predators in Oregon by diluting that information with 14,000 who are very much likely low-level offenders. I did pull the list off the predatory site, the one that's already available. In the 97301 zip code here in Salem, you have 83 predatory offenders. Based on the amount predicted of increased numbers of offenders on the website, you can expect that to increase to 1,640 persons as registered sex offenders in the 97301 zip code. What happens at that point, and you're going to find that it's much more common for persons to locate sex offender information on these third-party websites, and they will have no idea whether a person's a predator or not. It will create confusion and also reduce public safety, where the predators are now able to hide among the thousands of other persons that are on these websites. If this is something that our legislature feels should go forward, there should absolutely be more strict controls on the dissemination of that data. I've got some options in here, such as not allowing them to pull lists, then the data becomes useless. From my understanding, their original proposal was from a housing organization that could not find the name of a person that was wanting to rent a house, something of that nature. It should be more than sufficient to allow persons to pull a name, a person's name. If you have a legitimate interest in knowing about a person, it should be by name only. To have it done by zip code or city is more or less appealing to people who want to take retribution or gossip type situations. It also hurts employers who have given offenders a second chance. It can also be very devastating in the fact that today everything we do is on the internet. We search for people's names and so forth. Children of offenders, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, so forth, if you search in a person's, type in a person's last name, you're going to find out that their relative is an offender, and this could be particularly damaging if an offender has a relative victim, maybe going to school, and somebody at school is looking up that child's name to find them on the web, on Facebook or whatever, and finds out that their brother or whoever is an offender, and then the questions start. Now you're victimizing innocent people, as well as to bring up the issues of, housing, people being thrown out of housing when the neighbors find out, people that are low-level offenders. So more or less to summarize, I really believe there should, if this is something the legislature is intent on doing, there needs to be more thought given to the technical process to get the information where it needs to be, and not just something of a curiosity for people to go look up. It should be for legitimate uses. There should be devices put on the website so that the OSP retains the control. There are ways to do that. There are ways you can implement devices to where you're ensured that only humans are looking at the site, not automated processes that are pulling that information. And once that information is out on the web, as one of the gentlemen said before, it's out there. It can't be withdrawn, even if a person's pardoned or, you know, and the data becomes outdated. So the state police should be the only ones that control that data. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ed, and thank you for being concise. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one more question of John?
Please. Yes, sir.
Okay, so you say that you're a sex offender, and and it occurred when you were a teenager?
No, I was in my 20s. Okay. It did not involve, it was a touch over the clothing. Very remorseful. I'm very sorry for what happened. I was incarcerated. I've had a difficult time. I've been offered jobs, had them rescinded after background checks come back, you know, for things that had nothing to do with working, you know, around children or what have you. My main concern is not for myself. My life is very difficult already, but for my family. We live in a more rural area. They will be, you know, if they type my name in, everybody in town knows, everybody around knows. I just feel that, you know, this type of public directory, it doesn't serve any purpose. You know, I'm very low risk offender. The predatory types, the research I've done, you'll find some in here. You know, the predatory offenders typically offend at a rate of 40% to 60% reoffense. All offenders, all sexual offenders have about a 5% reoffense rate. That includes the predatory. So if you exclude them, the reoffense rate is extraordinarily low.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Next, I'll call Dennis Fletcher and Vi Beatty, please. Dennis, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Thank you, Co-Chair and committee members. I'm just going to be real quick here.
You need to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name. This is the second time, and the first time was even worse. My name is Dennis Fletcher.
Thank you, Dennis.
And basically, I'm going to read a conversation between an offender and a victim. Of course, the names have been removed for anonymity. Coincidentally, this conversation wouldn't even have been possible had it not been for the treatment programs that are facing the acts, as well as the hard work of both, you know, the offender and the victim, and permission by the parole board, which started the process of healing. Basically, it's a real short text message. It says, "Good morning, how are you doing? All right, I guess..." And this is the victim responding, "All right, I guess. I read in the paper about the SO data last night. It says that it might go online. What does that mean for you and I?" It says, "This could be a bad thing. I'm worried about you." It says, the offender says, "Don't sweat it. I'm okay. Can I ask you a serious question?" She says, "Sure. Who do you think is more dangerous? Both have taken the steps to change their lives, to rebuild the destruction that they created in their victims' lives. But they're both being released after serving their sentence, a murderer or a sex offender." She responded, "They're both equally as dangerous, but everyone has unique circumstances. Though alike, no one is the same. They're both equal. I don't think anybody should be on a list if they have changed. Dwelling on the past is stupid and healthy." Basically, you know, that's just one of many conversations that I've had with my daughter.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much. And if you could address some of the questions you heard, we'd appreciate that.
Sure.
About how many people, sex offenders, are on the list, how many in the proposed list, and low-risk, high-risk, those.
Okay. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the manager of the Sex Offender Registry for the state of Oregon. To answer the questions first, there are currently about 17,800 plus registered offenders active in the state of Oregon. That means they're residing in Oregon, working in Oregon, or attending school in Oregon. That includes both adults and juveniles. To split it apart, there are about 2,700 juveniles on the registry as active offenders at this point, living in the state of Oregon. 210 of those have misdemeanor offenses, 437 have out-of-state offenses, Class C felonies are somewhere in the 600s, and then the rest are Class A or B felonies, as far as the juveniles go. High risk, we have about 1,300 persons designated predatory in the state of Oregon based on posting criteria, about 700 of those post at any one time. The rest do not. As far as low risk, medium risk, Oregon does not do a low, medium, high risk. The only high risk we have are the predatory designees. So for the Oregon State Police, who is mandated to collect information from registrations to determine low risk, medium risk, we have no ability to do so, nor do we have the information to do so.
Thank you.
Just to clarify current law, the first list in your handout is what we provide to the public currently. The names are omitted because under current law, we cannot provide you those names without a request. So I omitted them. You'll notice that for the adults, it gives the name, the date of birth, physical descriptors, if they're attending, working at, or carrying on a vocation at an institution of higher education, their city and zip, and their last registration date. The juveniles are the ones who are not currently under supervision, and all you see next to their blank name space is a year of birth. Again, we would list, according to statute, any institutions of higher education they're working at, attending school at, or carrying on a vocation at, and then their city and zip and their last registration date. The next list in your handout are the on-supervision persons. The ones that are blacked out are either housed at DOC or they're juvenile offenders who are currently under supervision. What Senate Bill 67 does is it allows us to merge these two lists together and allow the public to generate their list off the internet instead of calling the sex offender registry to have it sent to them in a PDF document or mailed to them in hard copy. Currently, when we receive a request, our standard response is this first list, the one that says off supervision on it. That's what we provide to the public. So rather than the public having to contact us, they would be able to simply generate that list through the internet.
Mr. Co-Chair, can I get a clarification?
Yes, you can, please.
Thank you, Ms. Beatty. I thought I heard you say you provided this list to us without names because current law says you can't provide the names unless specifically asked for them.
Yes.
But then I thought you also just said that if the public calls and asks for information, you send them this list with no names on it?
No, we send them the list with names. If you were to call Representative Nolan into the SOR unit and request a list for Marion County, we would provide you the list for Marion County that said off supervision on it with the names listed because we have received, by law, a request.
May I follow up, Mr.
You may.
But if I call, I'm just trying to understand what appears to be a split between if I call and say, I want to know if Mary Nolan is listed on if Mary Nolan is a registered sex offender in the state of Oregon, then you could provide me the list of all the Mary Nolans who are among the 17,000 with this information. I don't understand how if I'm in my request I'm supposed to ask by name, if I were to say to you, How then are you allowed to provide a list of Marion County if I haven't said, well, make it Multnomah County? I want to know any Mary Nolans living in Multnomah County on your list.
Co-chairs Barker, Krieger, Representative Nolan, members of the committee. The specific statute, ORS 181595-3, states that the Department of State Police, City Police Department, County Sheriff's Office shall release upon request any information necessary to protect the public in a specific area or by a specific name request. So if you were to call and say, I'm interested in Mary Nolan, who lives in Multnomah County, if you were talking to me or my staff on the phone, I would run a request through the system for Mary Nolan. If I have a Mary Nolan and it is not in Multnomah County, I would tell you that I have no Mary Nolans listed in Multnomah County because that was your specific request. However, if you were to call and say, I'm a parent, I'm concerned, I would like a list of all the sex offenders in Marion County or Multnomah County. For Multnomah County, I would probably ask you to define a zip code area because it is the largest registered offender county that we have. And then,
just so I can clarify, so I can request information by name or by some other descriptor?
By city, county, zip code, or by name.
Okay.
Representative Schaffler?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. Is there anybody else left? I have a question of you. Is there anybody else left to testify after this?
No.
All right, well, I just have to make this comment then. You know, we're talking about some pretty heinous crimes here, and I haven't heard from anybody who's been victimized by this. But you know what? They're out there, and that's where my sympathies lie. That's where my vote lie. And if we save one child from being abused by passing this bill, it's worth every bit of it.
Thank you. And, Ms. Beatty, I just, on my cell phone, just hit an app that says sex offenders in your area, and I said use the current location. They just gave me a whole long list of people. I mean, it's just interesting, some of the testimony we heard, it will load a picture and a physical descriptor of people, and I don't know where that comes from. I mean,
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, we don't know where that information is coming from either. We are not supplying it to any organization or company that can then redistribute our information. Since it's for our predatory sex offender information that is currently posted to the public website, that information is firewall protected. I will verify that information and get back to your office later this afternoon. But my understanding from our programmers is that while no system is 100% foolproof, persons are not able to hack into the system and download that information.
No, it doesn't have these. I've just looked at a few of them. They don't show the offense. So it is maybe they get out of the newspaper, out of a court case or something in there.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I do understand that certain companies do have access to the Oregon Justice Information Network, OJIN, and they can access court records that way.
Okay, and so the testimony we heard today is accurate, then if we pass this bill, we'll be loading up 17,000 people that will go on the Internet, is that?
It would be list generation. So the thought process here is not to have you log into the website and see 17,000 people pop up. You would be asked to generate a list, and I'm not sure what the verbiage is yet.
Uh-huh.
And then you would have to identify your city, county, or zip code area, at which time the system would generate the list that we've handed out. And that's the only information it would provide. For follow-up on what the crimes were, that sort of information, they would have to contact either the city police department, county sheriff, or state police office for further information. At that point, based on statute, which is not changing with this bill, the agency would determine what level of information is necessary to protect the public on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Krieger, before you leave this, I thought it was in 2005 we did a bill that separated the distance between 3 and 5 years for statutory rape. Remember that? I want to go back and take a look and see what that included. Specifically, Representative Schaffler, adult pedophiles, rape of any kind, forcible type things, I agree with you entirely. But I would contend, but that would make every man stand up who isn't guilty,
that at some time during your juvenile years when your hormones got out of control, that maybe you either touched or attempted to touch some part of your girlfriend. Should I ask everybody to stand up that didn't violate that?
I call you out of order.
If you did that on the House floor and the Senate floor, not very many men would be sitting. So we're holding our young people to a very high standard. I don't argue with that. Maybe we need to be talking about differentiating between, which we don't have, a very low type conduct. You know, we have to be careful that we don't do some of the things that we've heard could happen for these people for the rest of their lives. If you recall when we had our sensitivity training and they told me that I could not pat my wife or kiss my wife in my office before I go because someone in your office, it happened to be Mike, would see it, could be offended, and could file a complaint. So at some point, you know, before this bill moves, before I'll go to a hearing, there's going to have to be some changes. You and I have to get together with staff and the District Attorney's Association, I'd hope the defense lawyers, and see what is it that we're trying to really do. What needs to be in here as a safeguard for pretty innocent young people? Your children, maybe one of your grandchildren someday has a moment of indiscretion when they're young, and as we say, their brains aren't working right, we know that. So we need some work to be done on this bill before it moves.
Representative Ure.
Thank you. A couple questions. Bye. Your written testimony, at the bottom you say the bill does not allow release of information for persons under supervision for juvenile adjudications. It does allow release of information for those persons after they've completed their probationary period.
Yes.
Is that existing law, or is this bill proposing to do that?
It's currently existing law, Representative Garrett.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up, please.
Can you help me understand the policy rationale for not releasing information about people who are still in their probationary period, but then releasing it once they've completed it?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Garrett, members of the committee, I can't give that rationale because I wasn't around when the law went into effect. I do know that since 1991, the Oregon State Police has been allowed to release information to the public upon request, not to the public, but has been allowed to release information to law enforcement. The public came into being in 1999 when Oregon passed its version of Megan's Law for release of information to the public on those persons who are no longer under supervision. Current law states that if a person convicted in adult court is under supervision for their first sex crime, if someone calls my office, I can reply that yes, that person is a registered sex offender. That's pretty much the only information we release. We refer them back to their supervising agency. If a person calls me on a person who was adjudicated in juvenile court for a sex crime and is currently under supervision, I am required by law to state that yes, that person is a registered sex offender. Then we refer them back to the juvenile supervising agency.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
May I ask another question?
Hold on.
A different issue. So I understood you to say you don't have the ability to categorize offenders by low, medium, or high risk, but we do have the predatory designation. How does that come about? I just don't know how this system functions. But how is it that we know who's predatory and who's merely high risk, and what's the difference between the two? Can you just say more about that?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Representative Garrett. ORS 18159 or 585 states that we shall assess persons for predatory designation or status if they have been convicted of rape, sodomy, sexual penetration with a foreign object, or sex abuse, any degree or any attempt. Only those persons who have what we refer to as a Big Four crime can be assessed for predatory. Once a person is assessed under the statute, that we have to use a tool that is designated by the Department of Correction. Currently, it's called the Static 99. It's the most objective validated tool that Department of Corrections has located to date. It was validated in the state of Colorado. It looks at various things for an offender, how many charges were listed, how many convictions were made, was the person involved in a relationship of 2 years or longer with one person. It's validated for adults, not for juveniles. It's validated for men, not so much for women. It also looks at non-sex crimes that are violent in nature. So any non-sexual violence crime is factored into this, and it scores. The Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision has basically laid out the requirements for predatory designation. Currently, based on some Supreme Court rulings, the last of which was VOY back in 2005, persons have to be provided due process. They can challenge the designation, and they have that opportunity. They can appear before a board, and they have a hearing. In order for them to even be considered predatory, they must score a 6 or above on the static tool. From the predatory assessments that I have done on persons moving into this state, I will tell you it's extremely hard to get a person to 6 or above, so there aren't that many persons being designated predatory.
Can I ask one final
question? Yes, you may.
We heard previous testimony about the percentage rates of reoffending in the offender population at large versus the predatory population. Did you hear that, and do you agree with those numbers? I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I just want to know if that's generally accepted as true, or if you have a different view of what those rates are.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Garrett, members of the committee. My understanding from my contacts at Department of Corrections and Oregon Youth Authority is that predatory sex offenders do have a higher rate of reoffending. Other sex offender groups have a lower rate of reoffending.
Do we have any knowledge of the reoffense rate for the non-predatory offenders broken out by different classifications, or is there just predatory and non-predatory? And if it's the latter, what is the rate of reoffense for the non-predatory offender?
Representative Garrett, Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, that would be a question for Department of Corrections. I do believe they keep those statistics.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, DOC and OYA keep those statistics, and I can help you.
Thank you,
them.
Mr. Chair. I'm done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also online. I'm on sexoffenders.oregon.gov. .gov is typically a official site, and very clearly, I typed in Hicks. It's got two guys. It's got pictures. It's got details of the crime. What is going on? I guess I'm not thoroughly understanding what the change is here. It seems like we're already putting this out.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Hicks, members of the committee. What you're seeing at Oregon. sexoffenders.oregon.gov is the predatory sex offender site. The only persons posted by law to that particular site with that amount of information are those designated predatory or sexually violent dangerous offenders.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To my good friend, Co-Chair Krieger's comments about teenagers, I mean, I was 14 once, too. But my good legal counsel right next to me has made it clear to me, you know, which I already thought, if you have a 14-year-old boy and a 14-year-old girl, they're not going to be convicted of some kind of sex crime if they're out there doing something that, you know, they shouldn't be doing, thank God. But now if you have a 17-year-old and a 12-year-old, I think that's a horse of a different color. And I think everybody would agree with that. Now, I don't know where to draw the line on this, but I just want to make it clear, the minute you turn 18, the world changes for you dramatically. Oddly enough, when I was a kid in high school, on November 24th of my senior year in high school, I could legally go into the tavern and drink beer. Now, I'm glad we repealed those laws, and it's 21 now. But things change radically, and I think, once again, I'm going to say it again, I agree we need to protect our young people that are doing things in an innocent environment. But if this passage of this bill, amended or not, save one kid, one child from being victimized by people that I am not very sympathetic to, then it's worth it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I live in Milwaukee, so say I have a house permit there, and I'm trying to get into the registry. So when you give me a list of names, that would be for all offenders in Milwaukee, including the predatory, the people who've committed multiple crimes, as well as the kid who now had committed a crime at 14, was found guilty, and is now 18. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei, members of the committee. I'm not sure how to answer the question, so I'll go this direction. If you call up and you tell me that you are a real estate agent and you have a client who is interested in how many sex offenders live within a certain address, because Oregon law states shall release upon request information that may be necessary to protect the public, I will not release to the realtor a list of sex offenders, all sex offenders who are off supervision, and their addresses. However, if the client wants to call me and state, I have personal safety issues, I have daughters I'm trying to protect, or young children, etc., and provides a reason that provides a public safety need, I will send to the client of the realtor that list, but I do not supply it to real estate agents.
I can follow up. I'm sorry, I'm not very clear. So if this bill were to pass as it is, and I was the client then and I called you, what I guess I'm asking, is there any differentiation between the 18-year-old kid who committed a crime when he was 14 and the predatory sex offender who is a continual sex offender?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei, members of the committee. The list itself, if it's a posted predatory sex offender, usually has a P next to the person's name. On the internet that we're proposing, it would still have that P, the person could click on it, and it will take them to the predatory website and provide additional information. But in the list format itself, it would just have a P for predatory.
Follow up? You don't have to say all the others. So I guess what I'm trying to get at, say it wasn't a predatory sex offender. I'm trying to see if there's a differentiation between the kid who committed an offense when he was 14, an adult who had maybe committed several different offenses, but maybe didn't have the P after his name.
There would be no differentiation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Just I wanted to thank Vi for being here. And we're probably going to have to talk to you in a room about some of the things we may want to try to do, and maybe you can keep us on course a little bit.
It would be my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 67. Open a public hearing on House Bill 62.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 62 approves the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission's adoption of 2 administrative rules and its amendment of 7 administrative rules. Oregon revised statutes require the commission to review legislative changes to criminal laws, to adopt and modify administrative rules consistent with such changes, and to submit sentencing guideline modifications to the Legislative Assembly for approval. So this bill, Senate Bill 62, comes from the commission and represents its compliance with Oregon law.
Mr. Prince.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I think Ms. Ross explained what this bill does. This is the bill we do every session when you all have changes to crimes in 09 that we then look at the legislation and we reclassify something. That's what this is. I've submitted some written testimony to show you what each of these rules does, and I'll go through that real quick if you'd like. The first one, 213-018-0022, just puts in the rules the crime of assault 3, where there was an operation with a DUI driver. That one, the legislature actually said, you shall classify this as level 8, and we just did that. 213-003-0058 It was another one of those where the legislature made an amendment in 2009 to Sex Abuse 2, where the offender was a coach and the victim was under the age of 21. We categorize that as a level 8. 213-003-00001. This was adding felony animal abuse and aggravated animal abuse to the person's crime list. I believe Heidi Moad testified on that to our commission and might have already testified this year to the legislature regarding the connection between sex abuse of animals or abuse of animals, excuse me, and future crimes against people. So that's the kind of thing this is. I would be happy to go through it. Mr. Chair, if you want me to continue, I will.
No, that's fine, because we're just going to hold the hearing today. We're not going to move it.
So if there's any questions, I'd be glad to ask them. And if not, thank you for your time.
Does anybody have any questions? It's pretty clear, so we're just catching up with...
Correct.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Hicks.
I'll ask one question. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Sprints. Looking at 001... So 213-0303
yes.
Says classifies ag harassment, okay, and harassment with offensive physical contact as personal crimes. What do you mean harassment? Are we talking the A misdemeanor version of harassment, but not the B misdemeanor version? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
One of them is...
I do. Co-chairs and Representative Hick, let me get back to you, but okay. When we broke out harassment, I will clarify which subsections are classified as person crimes, and I'll get that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to have a further discussion with you off the record, so that we're not taking up time in the committee, specifically with regard to the first bullet point under 213-003-001, and... considering those very serious crimes to be person crimes.
Yes.
Because I don't know what person crimes means, and so I want to talk
right.
with you about that. Thank you.
I'll set a time with your staff. Thank you.
I
will do that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Shaw.
Are they harassing the witness?
Every chance we get. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. Senate Bill 62. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 63.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 63A requires the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to condition release of persons who were on active felony supervision at the time of the offense that resulted in incarceration on the persons residing for the first 6 months in the county where they were previously supervised. It requires the Board to condition release of persons who were not on active adult felony supervision at the time of the offense that resulted in incarceration on the persons residing for the first 6 months in the county where they committed the offense. It provides for a waiver of this condition upon a certain showing of good cause for those persons who were not previously on adult supervision, declares an emergency as effective on passage. Comes from the board and reflects their actual practice, as my understanding, in cooperation with the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections to release adult inmates to the county where they were originally supervised.
We're not moving any bills today, so we're just having hearings, but please go ahead.
I thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger. I thank the opportunity to present the bill before the committee and members. And if you'd indulge me for a moment before I proceed, I did want to acknowledge Ms. Beatty's presentation regarding the...
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I've never been here before. I'm Aaron Felton. I'm chairperson of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And I said, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Krieger, I want to acknowledge Ms. Beatty for her presentation regarding the designation of predatory sex offenders just now, because we are the agency that actually does the designation of the make the predatory designation on individuals who would qualify for that. And we do hold the hearings. She mentioned the VLY case. That is a Supreme Court case which confers the right of due process on persons to object to the designation. We hold those hearings at our office on a regular basis. And I did find the urge to jump up and want to sit here as she was giving the presentation, but she laid out very well and very succinctly what our obligations and our duties are there. So I appreciated that, and she got it just right. Senate Bill 63A moves now into statute something that's that, as Council noted, what the Board and our partners in the Community Corrections Agencies already do in practice. It takes those very few offenders who are already on supervision who may be convicted of a felony while they are living in a different county, who come out of the Department of Corrections facility and want to move back to their county of residence, which is what current statute requires, that they be supervised in their county of residence. If they have already established a relationship with another county where they're being supervised on prior convictions, that for the first 6 months of their supervision, that they be supervised by the county in which they previously have been supervised prior to their going into the Department of Corrections facility. It allows that relationship to continue uninterrupted. The board believes this is a better practice because it allows the supervisor, who may already know them, have established a relationship with that individual, to continue. We believe that's in the better interest of public safety, better interest of the offender, so that there can be an uninterrupted break in supervision, and therefore the new county of residence doesn't have to open up a new file, get to know that individual, and basically start over. So as in the additional information piece of the written testimony I've offered there, those elements can come into place. So that's my formal testimony. I'd be happy to offer any questions. By the way, it has the support of Community Corrections Agencies and Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting. So, you guys work with probationers all the time, and so, but I'm interested in your elaborating on observations about how it sounds like you're getting better results releasing the offenders back into the county from which they came, when commonly, the drug culture that they're sort of led, we could say, to them getting into prison in the first place is in the county from which they came. And so some people may, recognizing from the alternative incarceration programs, recognize that they need to get out of that scene and want to go somewhere else. Would this bill, is that something that's valuable to consider here, and would this bill allow for that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Vice Chair Hicks, you're exactly right. This allows the flexibility to basically get them out of, well, one, here's an example. You'd want to get them out of, and this is what the statute envisions in the first place, get them out of the county of conviction, per se. If they're convicted in a place where they're committing their crimes, but not living there, perhaps going over there to commit their crimes, but not living there, it certainly would take them away from there, which is what the statute initially anticipates, get them back to their county of residence. But if they're basically also supervised in a different county than perhaps where they're going to commit their crimes, it would do that. But also, this would anticipate, after the 6 months has elapsed, you could then arrange a situation where they could go back to a different county in that they were living in. So it does allow flexibility. Have I anticipated your question? Because I think you're trying to anticipate some flexibility still mm-hmm. being in there.
Mr. Chair? Yeah, so, okay. Immediately upon release, they're going to go back to the county from which they came. Is that right?
They would go back to the county of residence, but they would still be supervised by the county in which they were previously supervised. Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Vice Chair Hicks, what traditionally happens in most cases is they're going to be supervised in the same county they're residing in. Yeah. But sometimes you have in situations where you have adjoining counties where somebody may live, say Polk and Marion or something like that, but they may be supervised in the adjoining county. This allows them still to be supervised in the county in which they've been supervised for a long time, but they wouldn't have to move out of the county where they've established residency.
Thank you. Okay, I'm following that. And so, and I haven't parsed the bill, but is this leaving discretion in who? The PO's hands? The court? How would the discretion be exercised?
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Vice Chair Hicks, the discretion is exercised among the community corrections agencies. It's been the practice that community corrections agencies have been able to work out between themselves agreements to make this happen between agencies. What the bill does, it allows these formal statutory authority for what's basically been informal agreements to be recognized in statute. So rather than sort of a patchwork of informal agreements in these few cases where this happens, it allows their allows statutory authority for them to happen without question. So you don't have basically community corrections agencies wondering, is there authority to do this, calling each other up to create these agreements. It's just allowed by statute. So that's where the bullet point about consistent response comes into place. So they know uniformly it's permissible by law if you were to approve the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Coach. And so, to be clear, this is regarding post-prison supervision, which is state-funded, right? And so that's probably why we don't have any counties signing up to testify on this. Is that, would you say so?
Well, the county...
I won't actually go that far, but yeah. We're talking about state dollars here and where specifically within the state we're going to spend them. Is that about right?
Mr. Co-Chair, Vice Chair Hicks, yes, this is state dollars, but we do have the support of the community of OACCD. So I think the community corrections agencies are in support of this bill because it makes their job easier.
Okay.
Representative Krieger?
Yes, Mr. Chair. in the last 2 years, I've had three instances where people had to be released back into the county. One was a sexual predator in Brookings, and then a young lady from Douglas County. The crime she committed was in Multnomah County. When she got out, she has some very severe health problems, relapsed back in with the wrong people. Her family wanted her back in Douglas County, were willing to take care of her, provide her home, food, medical, and we couldn't get her there.
Mm-hmm.
And is this going to help fix that when you have these type of situations or circumstances that are unique to some of these people that can't work, have severe problems?
It depends. Now, this bill, Mr. Co-Chair, this bill can do a couple of things. It allows flexibility. If she's on supervision there initially, obviously it helps. But it also doesn't change the overall existing ability of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to ultimately make a decision in an appropriate case if there are resources, job, family, like you've just described, decide that's in the best interest of the community or the individual offender in that case. If I've understood the scenario that you've described,
what it appears to be happening is Douglas County wouldn't want her to come back. So do they have to have the agreement of Douglas County before she can be brought from Multnomah County back to live with her family in Douglas County? Can they stop it?
Can Douglas County stop it? Mr. Co-Chair, the county, if it runs contrary to statute, and the statute as it is now requires a return to the county of residence, the practice has been to try to return them to the county of supervision. This bill, I'm sorry, I'm giving you a long answer, returns them to the county of supervision. If she was supervised in a different county, it would go back to the county of supervision. However, under special circumstances, special cases, counties have been able to make informal agreements between themselves. If they cannot make agreements between themselves, they've come to the board. The board is has the ultimate decision authority in these cases to make a determination. We are reluctant to use that authority. We encourage counties to come to agreements. It does not change that fact that ultimately the board could make a decision under appropriate circumstances.
I think, Mr. Chair, I got through the process with Max Williams and some of your people to the fact that Douglas County would not accept her back.
Mm-hmm.
I was never informed there was a further process. I don't appreciate that if there is.
Mr. Co-Chair, I regret you not getting the information you needed. That wasn't the right result. Whatever result occurred in that case, you not getting the information you were seeking is not the right result. But ultimately, the statutes contemplate that the board has the authority to make those decisions in the final call, as it were.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 63, and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 68. And Councilman, if you could just tell us about this. I don't know that we need additional testimony.
Yes, Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, and Chair Krieger, members of the committee. Senate Bill 68 updates statutory language to conform to current Department of State Police structure and practice. It came from the Department of State Police as the result of a comprehensive review of ORS Chapter 181. The person originally available to testify, I guess, isn't today. Captain Travis is available to Captain Travis Hampton is available to answer questions. But that's the bill is a statutory overhaul.
Captain, you come up. Does anybody have any questions for Captain Travis? Looks like you're going to get off here pretty scot-free. So we appreciate you taking the time to come over.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay, and we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 67. No further business before the committee.
Adjourned.